Okay, well, hello everybody. it's a great pleasure for me to be here. I finally made it. this is going to be an experimental talk where we explore the behavior of a frustrated quantum antifer magnet, and we observe quite unusual effects, which one may call exotic, so will probably fit into the spirit of this conference. I'm mainly going to present neutron scattering experiments of the order and excitations, and my main collaborator for this work is Alan Tennant from St. Andrews University. We've also benefited from theoretical guidance from Alexei Tsvelik in Brookhaven, and some of the high field experiments were done at Hahn-Meiner Institute in Berlin with Klaus Habicht and Peter Schmeibiedl. I'm also going to show some quite recent magnetization measurements, which are also quite important in unraveling the effects of fluctuations. And these were done in collaboration with Yoshi Tokiwa in Frank Stegi's group at Max Planck Institute in Dresden. And the crystals were grown by Tilczynski in Poland. So the system I'm going to be talking about is a spin half antiferromagnet on a frustrated triangular lattice. And the main motivation for this work is to see if in such a two-dimensional frustrated context, the fact that we're dealing with extreme quantum spins, whether it leads or not to any new features in the order or the excitations. The added benefit of the system that we explore experimentally is the fact that the energy scale of the interactions is relatively low, so the full phase diagram is experimentally accessible. We can reach the fully aligned ferromagnetic phase, where applied magnetic fields have entirely suppressed all the quantum fluctuations in the problem. And in this phase, the problem becomes a lot simpler. And by contrasting the behavior in the ferromagnetic phase with the much more complex physics here at low fields, we can directly reveal what the effects of fluctuations are. Also in the ferromagnetic phase, we've developed a method to, directly image the spin Hamiltonian, which allows us to make a more direct link with theoretical approaches. So essentially, in this talk, I'm going to describe first the ferromagnetic phase, then spend some time about the mechanism of the ordering here in terms of magnon condensation, and then describe the more complex behavior dominated by strong fluctuations here at low field. Some background about the material. Cesium copper chloride is an insulating magnet. You can see a picture of a crystal is transparent here. So it's definitely an insulator. And the crystal structure naturally breaks down into layers where the magnetic ions are copper 2 plus, and in each layer they form a triangular arrangement. The orbital angular momentum is quenched and leads to near isotropic, within a few percent, Heisenberg spins. And within these layers, the interactions between neighbors are mediated by super exchange through to chlorines. This is quite a large super exchange path and gives rise to relatively low energy interactions of the order of a few Kelvin. And we're going to exploit this in experiments to be able to look at how quantum fluctuations are tuned by field across the whole phase diagram. Here are some measurements of magnetic susceptibility. Shows a typical behavior for a low-dimensional antiferromagnet with local moment Grevy's behavior at high temperatures, and then a broad peak at low temperatures. this broad feature indicates the onset of short-range antiferromagnetic correlations, and then at much lower temperatures, there is onset of full three-dimensional long-range magnetic order. The magnetic ordering is incommensurate. It's a helix, And this arises because of the frustrated interactions. There is a natural tendency for the spins to form non-collinear states. Spins like to point away from all of their neighbors, and there is some compromise that's reached. And in this particular material, the spin twist is about 10 degrees between neighboring spins. So this gives rise to magnetic Bragg peaks in the neutron measurements. And these are away from the nail position at an incommensurate value. So if we now apply a magnetic field and the spins spiral in the BC plane because and confined to that plane because of a small anisotropy that I'll come back to later. So if we apply a magnetic field perpendicular to this plane of the helix, then the magnetization increases, like so here, and then high enough fields, we reach saturation, where all the moments are aligned along the field direction. So this intermediate region here is a cone. So I'm going to spend some time describing measurements in the ferromagnetic phase, which does not have very simple physics. Oops. Oh. Right, before that, let me discuss some crossovers that we see using magnetization measurements as a function of temperature. So I've discussed before some measurements at low field, showing this broad feature indicative of short-range order correlations. And we describe the region just below that temperature, so this region here, indicated in blue here, as some sort of a spin liquid phase. And then there's transition to long-range order at much lower temperatures. And then with the applied magnetic field, as we increase the magnetic field, the region of the spin liquid phase is gradually squeezed. And then above full saturation, the behavior is very different. Now, all the spins are aligned along the field direction. There's a large gap to flipping over a spin. And the magnetization as a function of temperature here it just reflects the fact that you can thermally excite spins, spin flips across a gap. And so from the activation behavior of this dependence, we can extract an effective parameter for this gap, which increases with field. So now in the ferromagnetic phase, for Heisenberg spins, the fully aligned phase is an exact eigenstate, and this is also generally true also for the case of Hamiltonians having only rotational symmetry. And the excitations here are single spin flips, which essentially hop across the links of the lattice mediated by terms in the exchange. And the dispersion relation is simply the Fourier transform of the couplings. So by doing an experiment where we measure the magnon dispersion relation at saturation, we can directly extract all the couplings in the problem. There are no renormalization factors that have to be applied. From an experimental point of view, if one reaches this fully aligned phase, one also has access to quite a wide range of physics problems, in the sense that by closing the magnon gap with field, one can look at condensation phenomena in magnets in various dimensions, in with various geometries, and then with neutrons see how the correlations start building up upon going into condensed phase.
This technique is legitimate only if your Hamiltonian has spin symmetry.
Yes, yes. If there are anisotropic terms, then one can do a perturbative expansion which is valid in the infinite field limit. And upon further lowering the field, this is no longer an exact solution. But going to sufficiently high fields in any magnet, it's a valid technique to extract interactions. So even in an Ising magnet, if you go in perpendicular field, if you go to sufficiently high fields where you can describe the exchange as a perturbation, onto the local transitions. But I believe here we're much closer to a situation where we have spin conservation. So in this saturated phase, we make measurements of quite large fields, and then energy scans going up like so, using neutron techniques, shows very sharp peaks that are characteristic of scattering from single magnons. And there are two peaks because of small anisotropy in the system. But overall, if we can do scans like so throughout the two-dimensional plane, we map out the dispersion relation. And this tells us that we're dealing with quite a strongly coupled two-dimensional system. This is the dispersion along the exchange, the direction B, indicated here. And the dispersion here, which is half the bandwidth, is the dispersion transverse. So, and this dispersion is simply the overall shape here is simply the Fourier transform of just two couplings, J and J prime. So we extract from this both the absolute magnitude of the exchanges and their ratio. And this small anisotropy here, well, the splitting here is due to the fact that there's this small Dow-Shinsky-Murray interaction which prefers a certain chirality, and this sense alternates in between layers, and so the lower magnon corresponds to rotating in the correct sense, and the other one, of course, higher energy, corresponds to rotating in the wrong sense. And also there's some coupling between the layers, and we find out that these are the terms that are the order of a few percent. So the main Hamiltonian is that of an anisotropic triangular lattice, and then perturbation terms of order a few percent. Now, if we lower the field and we close the magnon gap, we see onset. We see essentially the Bragg peaks corresponding to spiral order perpendicular to the field, and one can regard this as a Bose condensation of the high field magnons. And we can look in detail at the scaling laws of this transition, and we find that the two-dimensional nature of the magnons affects some of the scaling laws. In particular, the exponent of the order parameter is reduced from the value corresponding to the 3D case, possibly closer to the exponent for a 3DXY transition. And then we also find that the ordering wave vector is renormalized upon lowering the field. So in this region here, as I start putting more and more magnons in the ground state, the ordering wave vector shifts. And this is also an effect not predicted by a mean field approach. And one can possibly regard this in this dilute limit as an effect of strong interactions and fluctuations. And this renormalization is very large. In zero field, it reaches a factor of two between classical and quantum. Now, such renormalizations are actually predicted by theoretical approaches of the full quantum problem for the anisotropic triangular lattice. both series expansions and large N approaches predict that for quantum spins, there is a tendency of the spins to form for more collinear correlations. So the instability to order or static correlations is moved, is renormalized from classical to quantum. And the value obtained experimentally is in fact in between the two results that come from the theoretical expansions. So the question that we want to ask in experiments next is whether quantum fluctuations also affect the nature of the excitations. So here is again the picture of the phase diagram. At the ferromagnetic phase, there are no quantum fluctuations, and they gradually build up as we come to zero field. So first, I'm going to show measurements in the spiral phase, and then immediately in the spin liquid phase. So in the spiral phase, we have the incommensurate Bragg peaks from the spiral order, indicated by these red points here. And these occur at plus minus Q, corresponding to two chiralities. And there's they oscillate in position upon going in the transverse direction. And the strongest inelastic signal is in the vicinity of these incommensurate Bragg peaks. And there is modulation of the signal, this wiggle, upon going in the transverse direction. This is a direct consequence of the frustrated couplings, for in the absence of coupling J prime, all of this will be commensurate. Also, now we can look at the high energy, the behavior at higher energies. So we find excitations are sharply dispersing away from the Bragg peaks, like so. And then effects of frustration are seen in the fact that this dispersion relation shows strong asymmetries between the two sides, left and right. So if you like, the frustration has reshaped the dispersion relation. And this effect is periodic in the Brillouin zone in a sense that if I measure it at L equals to 0, it's like so. And if I measure it at L equals to 1, now it's changed. The asymmetry has changed. So really, it looks like the dispersion relation has a full two-dimensional Brillouin zone periodicity. So in contrast to a one-dimensional picture where there will be no incommensurate modulation low energies and no transverse dispersion, no asymmetry. Now, the dominant scattering that we see is, in fact, bounded at low energies by these dispersion relations, and is contained within a wide range of energy wave vector space, as indicated in this color picture here, which is corresponds to this measurement. So the main result that we find is that the dispersion relation shows strong incommensuration and modulations in the two-dimensional plane due to frustration. And also another very important parameter that comes from the measurement is the fact that the velocity of the excitations, the slope here, is largely renormalized by 65% compared to the spin wave velocity predicted for the Hamiltonian that we're dealing with. And this indicates very strong fluctuations, and it's similar to the one-dimensional case where the spin-on dispersion is renormalized by 57% compared to conventional spin waves. And we're able to extract these renormalizations quantitatively only because we're able to see what the Hamiltonian is by going to the high field limit. So we're quite confident that these are the real numbers. So if we now want to look in detail of the function at the line excitation line shapes, and we start comparing first with spinner theory. Now, for an isotropic antiferromagnet, which orders in a 120-degree structure, there are three sublattices, and there will be three spin wave modes associated with this. Now, this turns out to be quite general for any helical order. There's, again, three spin wave modes associated with change in the spin component perpendicular to the plane by 0 plus minus 1. And this would give rise to sharp modes in the neutron cross-section, as indicated by these peaks here. So those would explain the asymmetric shape of the dispersion, the incommensuration, and the fact that there's some structure in the scattering at the lower boundary. But they fail to explain the very large scattering weight at higher energies. Even when we go to higher order in this theory, by including processes where two magnons are created simultaneously, such an S equal to Z0 and S plus minus 1, even that cannot account for the large scattering weight observed in the experiment. More fundamentally, this dominant scattering weight has a different functional form, different properties than one might expect for two magnons. So here's a scan showing a sharp peak at low energies that we associate with the magnon. And then there's strong continuum scattering, which starts possibly at slightly higher energy and goes up to much higher energies. Now, the expected two magnon scattering for this particular scan is shown in gray here, and it's multiplied by an order of magnitude just to make it visible. So not only the strength is very different, but also two magnon scattering would have no gap, whereas there is a definite onset of higher energies observed experimentally. And also the functional form of the scattering, the data shows sort of power law type behavior, whereas the two magnon would drop off much faster at higher energies. So from this we conclude that the dominant scattering in this material is not described by two magnons. So it's better described by a power law form. And, and we find an exponent eta of slightly below 1. In fact, it's 0.75 or so. So to make more progress, we now make measurements in the spin liquid phase. This is immediately above the ordering transition, where the spiral order has disappeared, and then the sharp magnon mode has also disappeared, but the dominant continuum.
Question: how do you distinguish the spin liquid phase from the paramagnetic phase?
The magnetic susceptibility along this line here. Maybe I should go back.
There's a maximum. We monitor.
Yeah.
There's a maximum of the other
phase. Yes. There's actually many more features, but probably this graph encapsulates it. So the magnetic susceptibility has a broad peak around about 2.5 Kelvin or so. And then this is the onset. One can describe this as a crossover to a region where strong correlations develop. Whereas the paramagnetic phase has no strong antiferromagnetic correlations. Also, in the spin liquid phase, we still have incommensuration and well-defined dispersion, whereas in the paramagnetic phase, spins are more independent.
So you're not really saying it's a phase transition, you're saying it's a crossover.
From the spin liquid to paramagnetic, yes, a crossover. I mean, really, this is a convention. By taking the position of the maximum in the magnetization, it's a convention to describe this crossover. Other physical measurements may show crossovers at a different temperature, but that's what we've chosen. But I think it's a physically well-defined property that the paramagnetic and the spin liquid phase are actually different. So go back. Yeah, so in the spin liquid phase, excitations are thermally broadened, but still one can still extract a dispersion, and one can see that the low energy scattering has incommensurate modulations. Oops. And also at high energies, this is now going in the transverse direction. The dispersion is still well-defined, is of the order J prime. So in the paramagnetic phase, there's no dispersion.
Transverse means perpendicular to the chain.
Exactly, yes. So sit at the zone boundary position for the chain and go transverse. So this is the dispersion, and it's of the order J prime. Well, the energy scales involved are relatively low. So we're talking about magnetic fields of 10 Tesla or so. So that's about 1 millielectron volt. So at the energy scale of changing the orbital overlap and moving out atoms about is much smaller than that.
Anyway, we didn't include that, so that's the answer.
But what do you think, how does the resistance behave? What's the
activity?
So how big is it?
So I think the fact we're dealing with much lower energy scales suggests that actually the field is only affecting the local moment magnetism, not the exchange overlaps and so on. So the main result of these measurements is that in the spin liquid phase where there's no magnetic ordering, the excitations are dominated by strong continuum scattering, and this shows two-dimensional incommensurate modulations. Now, to make progress with understanding what's going on, I like to review the physics of one-dimensional change. This is the case where J prime is zero, and we know that spin wave theory breaks down in this case and leads to power law correlations along the chains rather than long-range order. And then the excitations here are spin half spin-ons, which can be pictorially represented as domain walls. So take a central section of the chain and flip it round, and that would introduce essentially two domain walls which act like missing spin half objects. And these, in a full quantum theory, become the true quasi-particles of the system. And here is a measurement on a prototypical quasi one-dimensional system, KCUF3, Allen, Tennant, and collaborators. And you see that the scattering weight is contained within a double sinusoidal continuum. And this comes about because neutron scattering transfers the spin of one and creates two particles, and is the overlap of the dispersion relations of these two particles, which gives rise to this continuum scattering observed here. In this material, the interchain couplings are relatively small, of the order 5%. Also, the couplings are unfrustrated, the excitations are commensurate, and the high energy physics essentially looks one-dimensional. Now, in cesium copper chloride, we also observe very strong dominant continuum scattering, which is also isotropic in spin space. We've also probed that with neutrons. And so that would suggest that the origin of this continuum scattering was also spin-on states. However, the situation has some qualitative differences in the sense that the interchain couplings are now much larger, about 30%, putting us more into a two-dimensional context. The interchain couplings are frustrated, and also the dispersion relation is incommensurate and shows modulations at all energy scales. So this two-dimensional context raises the possibility that the parent state, which gives rise to the spin-ons in cesium copper chloride, has some intrinsic two-dimensional correlations, could possibly be a RVB phase with strongly fluctuating bonds, and then spin-ons being physically represented as the ends of a broken bond. So to summarize the experimental situation so far, we see that in the spin liquid phase, when there is no long-range magnetic order, excitations form continuum scattering with incommensurate dispersions, and this is the phase where we see deconfined spin-ons. Then upon going into the long-range ordered phase, spiral order sets in, and then the medium to high energies will still have dominant continuum scattering, which may be still described in terms of spin-ons, but at low energies, another mode appears, which is characteristic of an ordered phase. So possibly a fruitful way to think about this is in terms of weak perturbation, which sets in at the long-range order transition, the mean field effects that create an attractive interaction between the spin-ons, creating the magnon. Whereas at energies above this weak attractive interactions, one can see still similar behavior to the spin liquid phase. So I'd like to discuss now a bit more quantitatively the magnetization curves, which also give important information about the fluctuations. The first important aspect is the fact that the magnetization is strongly nonlinear.
Before you go to this, could you fit your scattering data with known forms in 1D for the power law?
It's similar to that. So the exponent is similar to eta 1, but slightly smaller. If we go to the regions where we probe the largest span of continuum scattering, there I think it's slightly faster decay than 1D. But it's similar. Any more questions before I move into this? Okay. So if we neglect fluctuations in a classical theory of a cone phase, then the magnetization would increase linearly with field after saturation. So the susceptibility would be constant after saturation and then drop to zero. What we see experimentally is actually a very curved magnetization, and in fact the area, the integrated area here, is a direct measurement of the energy of zero-point quantum fluctuations in zero field, right? Because both the classical state and the true quantum state have the same energy at full saturation, right? So there's very strong quantum fluctuations represented by this departure from linearity. We can also compare the magnetization curve with the prediction for the one-dimensional chains. So that's the case J prime equals to zero, and there are exact solutions for this problem, and that gives us the red curve shown here. So in the bottom diagram, I've now normalized the magnetization in terms of Zeeman energy divided by in units of J, and the spin such that it saturates at 0.5. So ferromagnetic saturation of 1D chains would occur at 2J, whereas what we see experimentally, the saturation occurs at much significantly higher fields, about 42% higher. So this is a reflection of the energetic significance of the frustrated couplings J prime. Also, quite an important aspect is, if you look closer, the approach to saturation is a lot steeper in 1D than what's seen experimentally. And I believe that's to do with the dimensionality of the excitations. And to gain some insight into that, we can start from a two-dimensional point of view, from the anisotropic lattice JJ prime, and then go to next order in spin wave theory. So include the zero-point motion of the spins. Take into account the fact that there is zero-point energy of half of h bar omega k, and taking an average over the Brillouin zone. And that gives us, that introduces some zero-point fluctuations, so that gives rise to a curved magnetization, and that's the green line shown here. So the approach to saturation is very similar in this approach and in the data. And one may think that possibly this is a good description of the physics in this dilute limit of high enough fields. The saturation fields are different because in the calculation I haven't yet included the coupling between the layers, which also costs some energy to overcome. But that's only about 5%, as you can see from the graphs. But this approach fails round about zero field here, where we already know that excitations are quite different from spin wave theory. So to summarize, we've characterized experimentally the insulating magnet cesium copper chloride and found out that it's a spin half Heisenberg antiferromagnet on an anisotropic triangular lattice, and the couplings are in the ratio 1:3. So the main experimental feature of the system is that it shows dominant scattering continua in the neutron cross-section, and this is a characteristic signature of deconfined spinons. We also find that the excitation line shapes could be described by power loop ansatz, which is similar to theoretical models where spinons are can be found, and we see that the frustration introduces a qualitative new feature in the physics, in that the dispersion relations now are incommensurate and they show strong modulations up to all energy scales in the problem. Somehow the system knows even the higher energies in the dispersions that frustration is present. We see evidence for very strong quantum fluctuations in the ground state, in the nonlinear magnetization, in the fact that the velocity is largely renormalized from classical, and also the incommensuration is renormalized from classical. So the ground state is very different from the conventional spiral. And then from experiments which I haven't shown, but if there is time, we can discuss. Also, we see large incommensuration effects in applied field, which could potentially be related to a picture of band filling of spinons in the ground state. So that's it. Thank you very much.
OK, we have time for discussion. Steve, in the back. So the question was that whether the experimentalist has the actual magnitude for the gap.
For the ordered moment.
I mean, the size of the moment, yes.
Yeah. We only have sketchy data on that, but the order of magnitude is about half up to three quarters of the full spin. Yes, it's about there, yeah. Experimentally, it's not, it's kind of a direct, it's a bit difficult to extract the full magnitude as there are many other effects involved. But it's that order of magnitude, about half, yeah.
Other questions?
So have you looked at the temperature evolution of spin-on continuum in your spin-liquid phase? Well, you only have one temperature?
We haven't done a full temperature dependence, but we've measured the spin-liquid phase and the paramagnetic phase. And in the paramagnetic phase, the low boundary has entirely collapsed. Mm. And there is continuum scattering. Oops. You're not seeing this, that's all right. So in the paramagnetic phase, that's at 12 Kelvin on this diagram, the low boundary has collapsed. And then there is scattering within, still bounded by this region, roughly. So all of this is now broadened out. If there are some specific theoretical predictions for how in detail this line shape varies as a function of temperature, that's potentially doable experimentally.
Actually, I want to make some short comments. So actually, large EN mean field theory will give you some, you know, some spin structure factor that looks very similar to your to the spin liquid phase. So as to the spectrum in a long range ordered phase, if you assume that your ordered phase is very, very close to the say, quantum spin liquid phase. Then in the large N theory, in the larger limit, there are deconfined spinons as well as condensed spinons. And so if you take into account that, also if you assume that in order side, your confinement energy scale is very, very small, so that above certain energy scale, deconfined spin actually exists. And combining all this information, you can produce some qualitatively similar spin structure factor. It is not a, you know, rigorous theory, but by combining, you know, all this information and this under certain assumption, somehow you can reproduce. Well, it doesn't give you this anomalous exponent because it doesn't include gauge field fluctuations.
Right. Okay. I've lost my microphone. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. In this space time, we have this critical regime and a spin liquid regime. I just wonder if you fix the temperature and move from spin liquid regime to this critical regime,
yeah,
whether this spin on background have any change, or you know, whether they have different behavior from spectral function point of view. You say the critical,
yeah,
is like determine the maximum, but whether from spectral function, can you see any difference between these two phases?
We haven't done that particular experiment. Would you not expect, though, that in the critical region you'd be dominated by, you know, this critical point for a condensation,
yeah,
of magnons?
Yeah.
And so you'd have a quadratic dispersion, and that could potentially be quite different from,
okay,
spinons in zero field.
So the, okay, yeah.
I think we understand this transition and saturation,
yeah,
I think we,
right,
can understand that,
okay,
simply in terms of a condensation of a dilute gas. And there'll be a critical,
okay,
funnel coming out of it.
Yes.
Which would be interesting to,
yeah,
explore actually with magnetization, look for parallel effects.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Is there anything you can do to try to drive down the ordering temperature, pressure, or I can't think of anything else other than pressure, but
potentially. Which,
okay, you haven't tried
pressurizing
it down.
So, why don't you show the diagram of the field parallel to the light? Does that stabilize?
Well,
is it a good question?
All right. Okay, the question was about the data for the field parallel to the layers because it stabilizes the spin liquid phase.
Okay, so if we now apply the magnetic field in the plane of the helix, there are some transitions along the way to saturation. in particular, we lose the incommensurate long-range order. There's a transition around about 3 Tesla to a phase where so far we haven't been able to find incommensurate peaks. We know they're not in the conventional places where you'd look for classical type bordering. They may be somewhere in the two-dimensional plane. We don't know yet. We're doing some more experiments to explore that. But there are some tendency in the system to other types of phases, which indicates that the spiral order phase is actually quite fragile. But we haven't yet completed the measurements in this region here.
You have a question?
Actually, I had a question. I mean, in the cuprates, you sort of extracted these multiple spin interactions by looking at neutron scattering. I was wondering whether these triangular magnets have something similar, or is it just that they're so deep in the insulating state that those higher order processes are completely negligible? Like force spin interactions?
Yes, I think if you were starting from a theoretical point of view, what's our understanding of these higher order terms, that they come out if you're closer to a metal, so when there is large hoppings around, then the system would be very far away from that limit. So the situation is quite different from the cuprates, where the energy scales involve, you know, T over U, sort of 1 over 6, here would be an order of magnitude less than that. So the exchange J is, you know, you say, you know, materials will be of order EV or so. So J gives a measurement of how strong the hopping is, and it looks like with the energy scales involved in this measurement, I think we're very deep into the insulating limit.
Yeah, you might have said it, but I missed it. How well does the transition from the fully aligned state and the ordered state, well, how well is it described by sort of mean field theory, which is what you expect?
Yes. So what we can look at experimentally is the order parameter of the condensed phase, so that's the diameter of the helix, if you like. Mm-hmm. And the exponent for that is about 0.3, whereas the mean field description for a three-dimensional hardcore Bohr's gas would be 0.5. So the exponent that we see is, I would say it's consistent with a 3D XY model. So you've got helical order break XY symmetry in a two-dimensional system, and so the extra dimension of 3D XY. Sorry.
I just want to understand this field-dependent data of the spin-down feature. In one dimension, people have done an experiment where before you get to saturation, the peak wave vector in the dynamical data actually shifts as a function of magnetic field because of the Zeeman splitting of the spin-down band. Just for small magnetic field.
Oh yeah, if you have a small magnetic field, then there is band filling of spin-ons, so the Fermi wave vector would change.
Right.
So
the question is, do you see something similar here?
Now, that physics is related. You only get incommensurate correlations in the longitudinal spin. And this is because you put fully aligned spins into the, you fully align spins along the field, and it's these longitudinal correlations that become incommensurate. So if we do the measurement in in-plane field here, we do see that the field drives the incommensuration to very large values of the order of the Zeeman energy divided by the exchange. So it fits in actually very well with this picture of band filling of spin-ons.
Initially, it doesn't look linear.
It starts from a finite value because the system is incommensurate to start off with, but then it increases three times more. So a very significant wicked value. And the slope of this increase here is in fact the Zeeman energy divided by the measured velocity of the dispersion. So in an experimental situation where the magnetic ordering is dominated by the longitudinal component, there we can see field-induced incommensurations. In the experiments that I've discussed before, with the field applied perpendicular to the helix, in the correlations transverse to the field, which is what the ordering is, there's no field-driven incommensuration. The band filling incommensuration is to do with longitudinal components. One way to look at that is that you put fully aligned spins in your ground state, and they sort of repel each other, form some sort of regular structure, and the spacing between them decreases as you put more into the ground state, and it's this spacing that is the source of incommensuration.
I had a related question about the temperature dependence of the incommensurability. So if you start, say, at zero field, as you heat the system up through the ordered phase, is there measurable temperature dependence?
No, we can't see any measurable change in incommensuration upon going from here to there.
And then in the spin liquid phase, if you look at low frequency at the where the peak is, does that show some temperature dependence?
No, it's essentially at the same position as the white points here are done in the spin liquid phase, whereas the solid points are done in the ordered phase. So it looks like the ordering is just stabilized by the interlayer coupling, but there's no other effect that drives the incommensuration. That's already set by the main Hamiltonian JJ prime.
Any prospect for doping these things?
We're trying. We've tried for some time and not succeeded yet.
What are you trying to do?
With strontium instead of cesium.
Basically materials problem in segregate?
Yeah, it's difficult to do that.
Any other questions under comments? Well, not less than all the speakers.